your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, October 30th, 2025. As we bring you a new episode, we hope you have a wonderful Halloween weekend filled with fun parties and plenty of candy. The World Series starts up again on Halloween with the Toronto Blue Jays finding a way to win 2 out of 3 in Los Angeles and come home needing one more victory to claim the World Series trophy. But Yoshinobu Yamamoto awaits, and this is a veteran Dodgers team with their backs against the wall. How do we view this World Series ending? Plus, the White Sox could be close to naming their new hitting and pitching coaches. And it's that time of the year. After several episodes reviewing position groups in preparation, the offseason plan project has arrived. We'll share how the process works and, most importantly, what the budget will be. In the end, James Fegan did an excellent job creating a list of starting pitchers that the White Sox could be interested in this offseason. Jim Margulis and I will play Siskel and Ebert by giving a thumbs up or thumbs down on the pitching options. So let's get started. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, gentlemen. I want to start this podcast with something that we've been working on the last couple of days, following the lead from our friends with the All Sports Scene and joining other White Sox blogs and podcasts. If you follow us on social media, you may have seen my videos or seen other posts from the various White Sox blogs and podcasts. If you haven't seen those social media posts because you are smart and you stay off social media these days, we at Sox Machine are following the lead from the All Sports Scene and participating in the Southside Food Drive by collecting donations. This virtual food drive is helping the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Every dollar donated buys 3 meals. Our initial goal was to raise $2,500. We have already surpassed that goal in the first day, so we raised it to $3,500. As we are recording this episode, our campaign is currently at $3,400. If you have the means, any help would be appreciated. We're not going to stop. If we continue to surpass the goals, we'll just continue raising them. But you can donate and participate in the Southside Food Drive by clicking on the link within the Sox Machine podcast page, check out the Sox Machine's event page, or follow us on social media as we've been posting the link there. And to all those listening that have already donated, thank you so much. This campaign will go a long way in helping our friends and neighbors in Chicago. Over to the World Series. The World Series did go back to Toronto because after an epic 18-inning Game 3, which Freddie Freeman walked it off with a big home run, the Blue Jays dominated Games 4 and 5, winning Game 4 6-2, and behind Trey Yesavage's 12 strikeouts in 7 innings, the Blue Jays easily won Game 5 6-1. James, the question now for the Dodgers heading back to Toronto, and I think it's a fair question, have the Dodgers run out of gas? Because in the last 29 innings, this Dodgers lineup has only scored 4 runs.
They're certainly in trouble. The offense isn't sputtering. I don't know if that's out of gas or like kind of like some issues that they've had like all season long. Like obviously like Mookie Betts hasn't really been Mookie Betts, all season long to some degree. It's a lot of like, Shohei Ohtani brilliance is dragging like the rest of the profile, which has been like not elite. I think that's been a theme all season. Obviously not to like pick on him, but we've probably seen like names mixed in the lineup that we maybe didn't associate with like Dodgers World Series lineups. Shout out 2016 draft, Alex Call. Great to see you, buddy. But like maybe we didn't like think he'd be starting in left field in game 5, the start of the season. And like Andy Páez was obviously like a big factor for them early in the season, but has been cold for a while. And yeah, it's probably unreasonable to expect him to reverse that at this stage. But yeah, they're kind of like a White Sox lineup. I'm looking at like 3 guys with an OPS over 720 on their roster right now for the series. And I could see Will Smith taking off and Blasiano that, and obviously Shohei Ohtani, a lot of it being in one game, but still by far like the highest OPS of any hitter in the series. But it's been a little one dimensional at that point. At the same time, like they have what's been a super weapon this playoff so far, and Yamamoto queued up. And if that works the way it has the last two times, which is as close as you can get to winning a game by yourself, then they just have all hands on deck for a game seven. And, you know, that could obviously go awry with the way their bullpen's been at certain points throughout the season and the playoffs. But is it at least a – I think anyone would take that chance, out of gas or not, especially to have a one-game winner-take-all game and you have the greatest player ever suiting up, probably not pitching. There were spots they could be in as much as they looked like totally just out of gas, and as you put it. Those last two games in front of their home fans with a chance to, before they lost both of them, to win the series at home.
And Jim, with Yamamoto starting game six for the Dodgers, can't think of a better starting pitcher for them right now as far as to start this last stand for this season. The note that I have is that the Blue Jays have scored at least five runs in this World Series in each game, except for game two against Yamamoto. So are the first five innings of this game crucial for the Dodgers in the sense that if Yamamoto doesn't look like he's going to be on pace to pitch another complete game, then Los Angeles could be in hot water?
Sure seems like it. I mean, you can always have a slugfest on both sides. Like you could have the opposite of Yamamoto, Gausman the first time around, and just both starters look like they're feeling the pressure. The offenses are responding after a day off. And then it turns to battle of the bullpens and a big mess. So it's one game, so it's hard to say, you know, that anything can be guaranteed. But certainly lined up, I think that the Dodgers, thanks to Will Klein's efforts, keeping Yamamoto in the bullpen versus having him have to make an appearance is a huge deal. Like I made the offhand reference at the, you know, on Blue Sky as the game was ending, saying like Will Klein could be the World Series MVP, and one game's work, not really, but in terms of like the shape of the series, and if Yamamoto had to pitch one or two innings in that game because of, you know, Klein looking wobbly, you know, he looks so good, even like he barely wobbled when he was out of gas at the very end, and you know, had he run into problems earlier, perhaps Yamamoto comes in and his entire schedule is thrown off. Now he's a guy in short rest versus a guy who warmed up maybe a little more aggressively on a standard bullpen day or a side session, so he should be ready to go. And you know, should he deliver another gem and pitch the Dodgers into a game seven, then yeah, I think he's your front runner for the MVP on the Dodgers side. So should the Dodgers end up winning it?
Yeah, I think right now through like game three, well, right now the betting favorite for those that are sports bettors, the Blue Jays are now the favorite, obviously, to win the World Series. They were not. Before the World Series began, the Blue Jays had plus 190 odds of winning the World Series. The Dodgers were heavy favorites. So that's why, even though the Blue Jays had a better overall regular season and had home field advantage in this World Series, that's why a lot of people are considering that this could be an upset if the Blue Jays do beat the Dodgers, even though that kind of doesn't make a whole lot of sense. A team with home field advantage won the World Series. What do you mean? And they had more wins in the regular season. What do you mean that's an upset? But again, that's just how people determine upsets these days, is from the sports books, whether you think that is right or wrong. That's just the narrative. And I think I'm a bit surprised so far, Jim, in how the first five games have gone, because we make such a big deal out of the home run in the postseason. Ball go far, team go far. And that was the case. Like in game five, two home runs and three pitches off Blake Snell, and the Dodgers never recovered. They did not. They only scored one run off of a 21-year-old rookie. That's why I'm wondering, in game six, there's going to be so much tension in the first five innings. I am curious on how Dave Roberts manages that game. If Jim, Yamamoto is already at pitch 80 entering the sixth inning, knowing that he's going to have to go to the bullpen, or does Dave Roberts do something crazy and pushes Yamamoto close to 120 pitches, knowing that this is your last start of the season?
I mean, Blake Snell going, what did he finish with, 116, 117, something like that? He hadn't thrown that many pitches in 3 years. Could be the case where, you know, it's more of a matter of stuff and more of a matter of like watching arm angles, watching velocity, making sure that he's not completely compensating for his delivery in some way that jeopardizes the way he looks next year, because they need him very much next year as well. It's not somebody, you know, like most of their bullpen, I think, is, you know, could be turned over, or could be a case of ride the hot hand there. And, you know, no matter what happened, just like, yeah, we'll find a replacement, because the bullpen has been the weak link for pretty much all of the year. But I think for Yamamoto, there is a little bit of care involved to where they just can't completely burn him if he's just throwing, you know, like 89 or something like that, still getting guys out with his array of pitches, but just looking completely compromised. He might be somebody who just, you know, given his willingness to pitch in the 19th inning, like he might've been somebody who will literally pitch until his arm falls off.
Yeah.
So I think there is some oversight on the part of Roberts, but I assume like if he's throwing well, and it seems like if he's throwing well, he throws efficiently. He's not somebody who, he gets hurt within the strike zone. He doesn't nibble himself to the ledge every inning. And then like after five or six, you know, he's allowed one or no runs, but he's somehow at 90 pitches. Like he seems like if he's rolling, he's rolling. Like I think, Yamamoto more or less sets the agenda for himself in that way. I think, however, you know, should it turn into a slugfest early and neither him nor Gausman are getting guys out, that's when it's just a case where I don't know if there's like a good bullpen decision for Dave Roberts.
No,
you know, I think it's just, basically just spray and pray when it comes to who he's warming up and who he's sending out there. And I think that's probably the biggest advantage that the Blue Jays have is just, you know, the Blue Jays bullpen isn't the best bullpen in the world, but I think there's a lot of versatility to it and a lot of handedness options that they like. And so I think, if you're trying to get through four innings of bullpen work with a lead or in high leverage, I think you can logic your way through it a lot easier on Toronto's side.
Did the Dodgers decide what they're going to be doing in center field for game six? I thought I heard Andy Páez was going to be benched. And then Alex Call was going to...
I didn't see that yet.
Sounds like a winning plan to me.
Yeah.
We'll see what they do in center field, because Páez has been really struggling and they don't want to put Tommy Edmund out in center field because he's got a bad ankle. I mean, is that somewhere you put Enrique Hernandez in center field and you move Alex Call to left field?
Teoscar Hernandez in center.
Oh, boy.
Test the old Kenny Williams adage that center is the most or is the easiest position to play.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I mean, is it Jameson Fisher, Luis Posada, like it's too late to get the
playoff. You just
got to
start rattling
guys. Get the
gang
back together.
Wow.
Get the 2018 Barons like going.
Blake Rutherford, I think he's just coming off independent ball season. Oh, he should be still warm.
Yeah.
You want to clean up a mess, you got to guys to get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
It's like the It's Always Sunny with the cat in the wall. How do you get him out? Another cat in the wall.
Little hair of the dog that bit you.
So if the Blue Jays are able to hold on, James, who do you think is the leading World Series MVP candidate right now for the Blue Jays? Vladimir Guerrero Jr. or Alejandro Kirk?
I think Vladdy's probably like the popular pick. Like they're all kind of bunched in the same like production level.
Right.
Like Edison Barger, Vladimir Guerrero, and Alejandro Kirk are all within like 20, 25 points of OPS of each other. I think Vlad Guerrero with kind of star power and the attention that he commands in that offense, I think he'd probably get the nod if it's close, just a hunch.
Okay.
Obviously Kirk's like driven in more runs and Barger had the, you know, kind of one of the biggest hits of the entire series, but yeah, I live in America. I see how voting works.
All right, so the Dodgers did not win in five, so I'm going to give you guys a reset. My original prediction, Blue Jays in seven, is still alive. So Jim Margulis, with the Blue Jays up 3-2, how do you see this World Series ending?
I'm going to say Dodgers in seven because I've been wrong all fall, and I want you to be right. So I think if I switch to the Blue Jays, the Dodgers will win, and I'll poison it. So I will take one from the team here.
Thank you. So Jim is sacrificing himself. James, are you going to be just as kind, or how are you feeling?
I generally think I talk to my family enough, but you know, apparently I find that a lot of them might find like what I say on podcasts their main like check-in on what they think I'm is going through my head. So I had my mother the other day. I didn't even remember who I picked. Say like, not looking good for your Dodgers in a text, and I was like, I didn't know I was committed to this, and I think my baseball writing career would me involve a lot of me saying things are going to happen that I don't want to happen, but seem like they're going to happen anyway. That would you know, not make it partisan, but apparently I'm committed to the Dodgers per my okay. mother. So definitely thinking like Yamamoto as a just looks unbeatable right now, and that could put it to, as we talked about, a situation where it's a single game elimination and one team has like the greatest player of all time. So
yeah,
I think that it could easily go either way. I lean towards it going seven a bit more because of Yamamoto and how he's looked. Yeah, let's go
all
down
right.
to seven.
So Jim and James still sticking with the Dodgers, but in seven. I'll stick with the Blue Jays in seven, meaning that we're going to get November baseball, everybody. So while you're passing out candy to everyone visiting your house Friday night on Halloween, should be an excellent game six. This has been a fun World Series to watch, even though the scoreboard shows a different story, but it's been very competitive in the first six, seven innings of the games. It's just been gets out of hand for the Dodgers bullpen if they enter the game pretty early. So we'll see what the Blue Jays do against Yamamoto a second time. Moving over to the Chicago White Sox. Now, we don't have official word, but the word on the street, James, is that the White Sox are hoping to name their next hitting and pitching coaches after the weekend. The timing makes sense, right? Because is this a desire for Chris Getz and Will Venable to have their coaching staff figured out before the GM meetings in Las Vegas starting on November 9th?
I don't know if that's like the specific goal. I don't know if they see the GM meetings as like this big media event that necessarily like the fan base at large is super locked into or knows is happening at a specific time. I do think this is generally around the time of year where you're seeing teams, especially teams that have been out of it, firming up their staffs. And like, they've been doing interviews for a while. And the people I'm hearing are the very likely options have already been in the building and kind of like gone through the rigor. So it's very final stages right now. And obviously they're not supposed to announce news on the day of the World Series, and they weren't quite ready to kind of have it out firm today. So it's going to get kicked towards after that. And that kind of sets things up for Monday and Tuesday. I was anticipating separate announcements, one for like the hitting operation and then for the pitching operation.
Okay.
But it definitely seems very imminent on the 1 yard line as far as, you know, things that need to be tied together. They've definitely made their choices.
Okay. So there you go.
I imagine when it comes to like hiring staffs, like, it seems like by the end of October, maybe first week of November, the managers are hired, and then managers for new teams have to finalize their staff. So it's probably a case of, you know, you are competing for certain staffers, you know, and it's probably a case of if you like a guy, put a ring on it early so other staffs can't poach him. But like
they are pulling assistance from other staff, so that's like it's kind of in the right pocket to do it early where of course the other teams now can replace them. So yeah, I think it lines up right for when a team that's been out of it and working on this for a month needs to wrap it up so it can enable other teams to kind of lock things up.
I was watching Foul Territory today, Jim, and AJ Brzezinski was talking to Aaron Gleeman, which Gleeman has been covering the Minnesota Twins forever, talking about the Twins hiring Derek Shelton. Jim, you were not a big fan of Rocco Baldelli for good reasons, and I think those repeated reasons over the years proved you right about Rocco just running out of ideas. What do you make of the Twins bringing in former Pittsburgh Pirates manager Derek Shelton to take over?
I think it's hard to judge in terms of wins and losses or expectations, because like, what do the Twins have right now? Byron Buxton and a whole bunch of bad vibes. The White Sox swept them in four games at Target Field. That's kind of how bad it got under Baldelli and just everybody checking out. So you need a new manager in there. And then it's a case where, given how things could turn, I can understand not wanting to turn it over to a first-time manager. I'm thinking like the Nationals with Blake Butera, 33 years old.
Wow.
Bold choice. It kind of reminds me a little bit of like the Justin Dursley project of trying to make a manager out of the minor leagues based on kind of somebody who's been exposed to it his whole life. And because he's Drew Butera's brother, he comes from a lineage of baseball people. Bold choice there, but I think for like the Twins, like if things could take a turn, like we saw at the White Sox with Pedro Grifol, he was brought in thinking he was going to be tightening up the ship, and they had a team that was a postseason contender, and everything went south, and he just did not have a great handle on the personalities or the public messaging or anything like that. So I think having somebody who's been through it before, having somebody who's been through it before on teams that are not supported by ownership, probably an asset for the Twins. I don't think they're in a position right now to where you burn a great managerial candidate on a downswing, perhaps, or perhaps a protracted lull. They have some prospects. They have a decent farm system, so like they could be poised to bounce back to respectability. But in terms of what ownership's going to do to spend and to help support it, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot there. So I think Shelton's fine. I think just any manager is more or less fine for the Twins at this point, because it really comes down to like what the poll ads are going to do in terms of just how much they are trying to generate excitement themselves.
Yeah. What the vibe I got from that Foul Territory interview was, well, Shelton's at least used to losing.
Yeah. And he's been with the Twins. So he came up coaching the Twins. So they know him and he kind of knows the deal. So, and I don't think he was, he lost his job in Pittsburgh because of,
right,
hobnutting and just the very way they're run there. But I didn't hear anything about mutinies or losing the clubhouse or anything like that. So it seems like, he's to a person, and that's probably pretty important at this juncture for the Twins. Like, to a person, he seems like a decent manager. And that's probably the priority right now.
We'll wait to see the official word from the Chicago White Sox, or if we're able to break news on Monday or Tuesday on who the new hitting and pitching coaches will be joining Will Venable's staff. That's important because our next topic, and will be kicked off this weekend on SoxMachine.com, is the offseason plan projects, in which that was going to be one of your tasks, is deciding who you would hire as the next White Sox hitting and pitching coaches. This is one of my favorite times of the year on the website, in which you podcast listeners and those that visit SoxMachine.com on the daily, you get to be the general manager of the Chicago White Sox and explaining the process and the format change in submitting your plans this year is Jim. So Jim, go ahead, lay it down for us. How is this going to work on SoxMachine.com?
It's going to take the same shape in terms of the same order of things, your overall vision followed by all the mandatory roster decisions you have to make when it comes to options or buyouts, arbitration eligible players, etc. Still be asked to sign some free agents or make some trades and come up with a 26-man roster that's within the realm of a set budget. So like that's all the same. The only difference is we will be running it through Google Forms this year. It'll still show up as posts on Sox Machine. Normally it's a case where the posts go into the system and I have to tabulate on the back end in terms of collecting all the names, the percentages for what people decide to do with arbitration decisions, tendering contracts, etc. This case, it'll go into Google Forms. I'll be able to see real-time tabulations in terms of what people are doing with what decisions. Be a lot easier to do Control F for most popular free agents or most popular trade targets and go from there. I will have to do the mandatory entering into the system on our side to get the posts up with the proper credits involved. But giving that a shot this year. Should be a more exciting one because you do have a fair amount of fixtures in place, or you hope that they're fixtures when it comes to the prospects. Now it's a matter of how aggressively do you support them right now versus, do you trade anybody right now from that core to move around resources to positions of greater need? I think, it was a bit of a low watermark last year just because coming off 121 loss season, Chris Getz taking a sweet time promising more wins in 2025 than he did in 2024, even though it'd be basically impossible to lose more games than the White Sox did based on what the Rockies did in 2025. But I think this year feels like there's more going for it in terms of generating ideas and hopefully readers inspiring other readers with the ideas that they have.
All right, so that means it's time for the big announcement. Jim Margulis, what is this year's off-season plan project budget?
I wish it were a bigger announcement, but for this year, I'm setting the budget at $90
million. Okay.
When it comes to the budget, obviously, there are your job as GM is to argue for more resources. So if you have, end up $95, $100 million, sure, if you can argue it, go for it. And, and we have people who don't pay any attention because they believe Jerry Reinsdorf with Justin Ishbia behind him should be spending $150 million. And so you'll have those plans as well, which, I would not argue against that. It's just a case where I'm just trying to set something semi-realistic. And for me, if the White Sox bring back Luis Robert Jr. on his option the way they say they are, and they tender all contracts to arbitration eligible players, which they might not, but in terms of it's not because of money, it's because of just individual value, you have a payroll of about $60 million, and so that gives you $30 million to add. If you think that you can do better with Robert or the money he's being owed, that's all of a sudden you're more than doubling your payroll basically. So yeah. I feel like it's a lot of room to play with and be creative while also having the veneer of realism to it, even though my fear is that the number will come in significantly lower. But I think $90 million after bouncing it back and forth feels right to me.
Yeah, and I think $30 million seems about right, James, the last couple of years and what the White Sox have spent total. I mean, they've signed a lot of guys.
A lot of guys.
They really stretch out that $30 million. Just remember Slater, Talkman, Rojas,
Taylor,
Martin Perez,
Bryce Wilson. Just claiming Matt Tice off waivers. Is that part of the offseason for you?
Yeah. Penn Murphy.
Remember some guys, but just last year's team.
Yeah. Hey, we did ace that. You can go check it on YouTube. We did ace it. So we remember everyone that played for the White Sox. Thank you, Greg Jones.
Greg Jones, most of all.
We also got plenty of feedback that people were yelling, Greg Jones, at us while listening to it.
Love it. But for my offseason plan, and I am working on one, and I'll do a video and I'll show it up, I'll post on our YouTube channel, but I'll also write a post on SoxMachine.com. I think that's a fair number, Jim. I'm not going to push back. You giving me a $30 million budget. It's just in my head, it's two relievers, find a starting pitcher, two outfielders. And really that's the task on hand for Chris Getz. So I feel like the number that you're giving everyone, Jim, is going to be right about on target for what the White Sox enter next season with as far as a player payroll. So to try to find five players for $30 million seems right on par with the job that Chris Getz has. And that's what makes this fun. And I can't wait to see all of the trade ideas as well. That's an area that I'm kind of struggling with. Does anyone want anything from the White Sox at this moment, both in the minor leagues or even on the majors, if I feel uncomfortable trading Edgar Caro? So those are some of the thoughts, podcast listeners, that's swirling in my head as I work on my offseason plan. I have two weddings to attend this weekend. So in between weddings, I'll be strategizing and how I would handle this upcoming offseason if I were running the Chicago White Sox.
Same day or different day?
different days. I have one on Halloween, so I'm attending my first Halloween wedding, and then I have one on Saturday. I feel bad about the one on Saturday because I claim I do not know these people. These people totally attended my wedding. So I don't know if anyone's ever been in that position, but that's the position that I am in on Saturday.
The Halloween wedding, do you have to dress up for that?
They asked, do not wear costumes.
Okay.
But they are going to provide masks.
Okay.
So, yes, I'm excited.
I think if you're getting married in Halloween, you would lean into it all the way.
Get one of those blow-up
I guess,
T-Rex costumes, walk into your wedding.
Yeah. Well, at least maybe, I guess maybe for if somebody just, it's kind of like the bride wearing, or like the, you're not supposed to wear white.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it might be the same thing of just like, you don't want to wear the same thing and overshadow the people who are, who the day is for. So I get it.
Yes. Yes. I guess I could find David S. Pumpkins suit and wear that, but that, yeah, never mind. That'll be awkward. That would be awkward. But good luck to everyone in the off-season plan projects. Look forward to reading them throughout November as we get past the GM meetings and inch closer to the winter meetings. But an area that we all need help with, especially for me, because I'm already, I don't know for you podcast listeners, just staring at MLB trade rumors and the list of free agents and try to take a deep dive in who would be worthwhile for the White Sox to find to help with the starting rotation. But thankfully, we got James Fegan, and James wrote an excellent piece on SoxMachine.com targeting some starting pitchers. So we're going to play a little game. Jim Margulis and I are going to be Siskel and Ebert. We're going to give up thumbs up or thumbs down on the starting pitching options. So I am passing the hosting baton over to James. So James, go ahead and make your pitches on the starting pitchers that the White Sox could target.
To start, like a little peek behind the curtain. So I'm helping out on Fangraph's top 50 free agent list and writing some capsules. And a big part of my process was like, all right, who's not on that list? Because that's somebody that maybe we can think about targeting. And I tried to like keep the targets very reasonable, very in line with kind of what they searched for before in terms of, you know, even like putting out Chris's quote, which was more like about protecting young players, like suggesting they would need someone who was like going to take up their mantle of the innings. Obviously, like Martin Perez was like scouted to do that, but didn't. He wound up like being this different shape of pitcher where like when he was on the field, he was like undeniably pretty, really good. And then, but injuries kept him from really contributing. And then, you know, this, you could talk about what the stuff projects in the future, but it was kind of an inverse where it's like high risk, good output, where we're expecting more like bulk innings of variable quality. And that still is the kind of goal, is to make sure you get somebody who can probably, you know, take the ball 30 times and hopefully approach 160, 180 innings. But given what they're searching for here, the tier that they're probably shopping at, we know we're probably, if we're looking for bulk, we're probably sacrificing some of that quality and upside. That said, I did cheat and put like clear upside over actual reliability guys in there, but at the, maybe the scale where the White Sox could be conceivably shopping. So that was a little the idea. If you're wondering why, like, I didn't put Jack Flaherty in there or something, or other high-end free agent pitchers. That's generally the idea.
Framber Valdez.
We're looking. Well, I don't know. Framber Spearing, a rookie catcher, probably wouldn't be a great look for the clubhouse going forward. So looking for like your number four starter type du jour, your innings, your back end guys is generally the idea of what I was going for. So the start was just Martin Perez. Certainly has said many times that he's willing to come back. I don't think his price went up from what was affordable last year. Beyond last year's results, has generally been a guy who logs over 100 innings pretty regularly. He knows how to take the ball, knows how to maneuver through a lineup multiple times. That said, I, you know, obviously delineated my reasons for why I'd be skeptical for Perez in this role going forward. But, you know, having, you know, he said part of the reasons that like he wanted to rehab is that they thought a second TJ might be curtains for him. Career wise, where he's at this innings. And then after coming back from that, which was great, very inspiring, pitched well after that largely, then has the shoulder issue at the end of the season as well. I thought that's a little bit of too many red flags as far as like how many innings he's going to be able to count on next year before you even get into like the peripherals being not great as they have been for him for Pitt. So now that I've told you how to vote multiple times, Martin Perez, I'll put it up to you.
That's a thumbs down for me, Jim.
Yeah, I'm the witness has been led, thumbs down. it does feel like the, you know, the White Sox got a reasonable output from him, I think, in terms of just like quality. If you told me like he'd be around like one win above replacement, more or less, like, sure, like I could see that being the case. I would have expected to be like over 130 innings versus 56. So like the shape of it surprised me, but overall, like the contribution's reasonable, but it does feel like, you know, he's going to be 35. All the warning signs are there. And, you know, kind of reminds me of, you know, the wonders, you know, the short-term wonders the White Sox have had, like with, you know, Elvis Andrus and Johnny Cueto and James McCann, just like, don't smile because it happened. Enjoy it. Don't try to like go back to that well, because it's not likely to have the same outcome again. So yeah, I'm on James's side, and your side, thumbs down. A regretful thumbs down, I should say, because he seems like a delightful fellow.
Who's next, James?
So this is what I view as like my prime candidate, essentially, as far as like what I'm was looking for, which is Zach Littell, which is lots of innings, lots of strikes. Worry about the rest later. He is a converted reliever, but he's doing starting for 2 years now. Three straight seasons of sub 5% walk rates, which is very, very low. 186 innings or 186 2/3 innings last year. That would be the most innings a White Sox pitcher has thrown since Ivan Nova had 187 in 2019. So not seeing that level of like bulk innings coming along every day anymore around these parts. Strikeout rate, career low, is like 6 for 9 last year. His slider got whacked a lot. His splitter lost a little bit of a bite to it. If you look at like both his results and just like a pitch, like the, you know, the stack has a little like movement graph, he clearly like needs something going to like the glove side to some degree. And this is a question I have with like other guys in this profile, which is the White Sox were, you know, the big success story is Shane Smith, somebody who couldn't throw a changeup. All he could throw was spin. You know, Sean Burke was kind of in a slimmer boat. They got him a changeup. Can they do the inverse? This is somebody who is basically a heavy fastball splitter with a really iffy slider. It's toyed around with a sweeper. Can you give someone like this a slider or a sweeper or maybe like a cutter that like serves that purpose? Because he hasn't been able to neutralize righties as well as you would think, given that he's a right-hander himself. That said, obviously he's been able to pile up, you know, a lot of innings, and even had a sub 4 ERA last year, which almost kind of made me wonder if he'd be out of the White Sox price range. I certainly think he'd get 2-year deal. Maybe like the situation where the 1 3-year offer he gets is the winner. I'm thinking like the lack of bat missing, you know, the way the stuff is looked last year is enough of a warning flag to like maybe the White Sox are a team, like if they make him like a priority, they can, and they have like a good development plan for him, they can kind of swoop in. But you know, he obviously got jolted to the deadline last year, not a huge deal, but like the Dodgers wound up with a pretty good prospect. That kind of has how all trades with the Dodgers go, where they sneak out with a good prospect for no reason. But a contending team acquired with the deadline last year. So you wonder if like he's a little bit higher profile. I know no one listening to Sox is happy to hear me speculate whether Zach Littell is too much, but he had a very productive year last year where like he'll be on other teams' radars. He's not just like, you know, pure dumpster diving. So that's why I think he's kind of like, you know, premier level, but I turn it over to you for your assessment. I've been talking long enough.
Spot track, Jim, looking up Zach Littell's profile, Spot track, their market value for him is $13 million a year. So what they think a market value compared to what Zach Eflin signed for, Tyler Anderson, Trevor Williams, and Nick Pivetta, around the same age as Littell, these guys got 3 to 4 year contracts with an average salary of $13 to $13.75 million. If it takes like a 3 year, $40 million contract to sign Zach Littell, I guess my question is, knowing if I have $30 million in my offseason plan project, Jim, well, he easily fits in. And maybe because the White Sox might be the only team to offer a 3 year contract, that's how they can get Zach Littell into the starting rotation. Is that something that the White Sox are even interested in, though, right now? Is signing a starting pitcher like Zach Littell to be in their starting rotation over the next 3 years?
I think my reservations with Littell is that and this is difficult because of the noise of the Rays playing at Steinbrenner Field, going from Tropicana to Steinbrenner, which is one of the smallest parks. Kyle Teal's first homer was there, and Statcast said like that was the only park it would have left. The way it went out to right field, like even Yankee Stadium could have held it. So you know, when I look at him giving up 36 homers over 186 innings last year, like that spiking up on him while the strikeout rate drops, is it a case where he was just playing in extreme environments between that and Cincinnati, another very home run friendly park, and going to guaranteed right field or right field, I should say, won't faze him. On the other hand, like if his stuff is fading a little bit, I think it's incumbent on a 3 year deal to make sure that you're in a position to get the most out of that first year. And I think with the way the White Sox are shaped right now, and I think one of the other reasons why I'm comfortable with the budget at $90 million is because we've seen, like, it reminds me of 2015, 2016 when the White Sox tried to spend their way into contention, but not like breaking the bank. It was all like, you know, 2-3 year deals of significant, like, you know, $13 million AAV, which is, yeah. And I think Adam LaRoche is like my primary example of this. A 2 year deal for Adam LaRoche shouldn't have gotten in the way. If his first year was terrible, like they should have planned to be able to spend past it. If it turned out that he did not have anything left in the tank, and didn't, they let that hang in the books. You know, he went into spring training, the whole LaRoche thing happened, and then he retired, and then they got the money back, but it's too late to sign anybody of note. So if I'm Chris Getz and I have an understanding of like how Reinsdorf has maybe pulled the football on his front offices before, I don't think they're at the juncture yet to where you can have a 3 year deal that's that doesn't have a whole lot to offer at the end of year three, which I think would be my my objection with Littell. I could see 2 years like being reasonable, like you know, even if the Pam, and even if like it turns out to be a dud, like who cares if he's getting in the way of the 2027 payroll? First of all, who knows what that season's going to look like? Second of all,
right.
Just the White Sox probably won't be on the doorstep of October. So I think, you know, 2 years of anybody is fine. I think just, I wouldn't compete for three based on where the White Sox are and what they've done when they've had to have players age well in order to be able to spend what you think they have to spend at the most important points.
So let me follow up. What if it takes 2 years at a team option for year three with like a $5 million buyout? So it's a 2 year contract, $14 million each season. So 28, if you opt out for 2028, he gets $5 million. If you opt in, he gets $13 million for that third season.
Yeah. I mean, something like that, or they could just pay him like a third $13 million salary paid out over 10 years, the way they do with Liam Hendricks, are very proud of the way they structured it.
So James, I think Jim and I are both a thumbs up on Zach Littell. If it's at most a 2 year contract with a team, a club option for year three, if it's supposed, if he's asking for three guaranteed years, I think I would pass. Would you, Jim?
Yes.
I mean, I would think the stuff that he has profiles like less than, say, Pivetta, you know, at the similar juncture. And I would think like he would even slip a little bit from like that market. But obviously, we'll see like if there's a run on pitching or everyone just wants somebody who will actually stay upright and throw tons of innings. Or magically, it will only be the Sox who care about that. Speaking of which, lower down on the level of guys who threw a lot of innings last year, Chris Paddock threw 158 last year. It wasn't too a good ERA the way Zach Littell managed. And you either have the the Twins and Tigers both tried it to poor results last year, or man, would it be fun to get one over on them, appeal for this. But he's also in a similar boat of like, this is somebody who, I mean, because Paddock, I think it's a lot more obvious. He's like a high slot guy with like the big right four seamer. He's always relied on his changeup. He's never really had this like reliable breaking ball. So he's not had reverse splits, but he's never like gotten righties out, you know, exceptionally well at any point. I'm sure a lot of smart orgs have wasted a lot of energy trying to see like what breaking ball they could give, you know, Chris Paddock. And he obviously had a kind of good stretch midseason when the Twins like, you know, went on a big winning streak and looked like they would, you know, would be, you know, in the mix at least for the AL Central competition and not, you know, stripping the operation for copper wire by September the way they wound up being. But you know, Paddock wound up kind of progressing pretty hard and not really being able to help the Tigers on stretch. But there's obviously been injury stuff in his history, and this is kind of like one of the more closer to full seasons he's had since he, you know, went down for TJ. There it is, a, you know, good fastball, you know, metrics wise, and while his changes not performing well, you wonder like if there was anything that could take pressure off it, whether he'd get better results for it. And it is something that he's had, you know, good strength for throughout his career. It's definitely, you know, kind of a fixer upper in terms of what his results were, but he is, you know, a proven starter. He does have strengths that they could, you know, ideally act upon or, you know, emphasize. And, you know, he's throwing innings. He is a major leaguer. So I feel like this is not my best sell job, but I also feel like it's going to just go on longer rather than get stronger. So Chris Paddock, what do you say to him?
I'm good, Jim, on a 1-year deal for $10 million. Paddock is a Scott Boras client. So I think Boras would understand having Paddock sign with the White Sox, a guaranteed deal that ensures that Paddock is a starting pitcher. Obviously, I'm sure Paddock would love to pitch for a team that has a chance to win, but I think they need to weigh what that is for Paddock, at least to start the season. Because if you do sign him to a 1-year deal and he does pitch well, then he could always be traded to a contender. So I think with Scott Boras's point of view with this client, that it's whatever team can guarantee Paddock a job in the starting rotation, the White Sox can do that. And I think at most I'd be comfortable for like 10 and a half million for one season.
10 million seems steep, and I guess we'll find out if I'm valuing players correctly. But just, I think with the 5 FIP, you know, it's a case where he's at like a sneaky underperforming, yeah, we can mine something greater out of him as his previous organizations have misused him. I think he's somebody who's, you know, more is what he is until he proves he can do something different. So that's why I think like the price would be, I was thinking like 5-6 million would be where I would put him. And that would be kind of like, okay, I would get it. It would be like a thumb sideways for me. Not the most exciting. Like I remember when he left the Twins and was traded from the Twins and went to the Tigers. And he talked about how the Tigers organization is a whole lot more going for it in terms of amenities and development aids than the Twins had. So I wonder I guess we'd find out where the White Sox are if he leaves the White Sox midseason under terms he's not the happiest about. So I would be for it in that regard, like the honesty and hearing that kind of evaluation of where the White Sox are in terms of what they're able to offer players. But yeah, I'm not terribly excited about him, but if it shook out where he ended up on the White Sox, I would get it. And so I would say like, all right, let's see, you know, see what we can do with that changeup or taking stress off the changeup with something else.
SpotTrax got Paddock last year making close to $8.5 million between his time with the Tigers and Twins. So would you be okay with a 1-year, $8.5 million deal, which would pay out to what he made in 2025?
It feels like that's a little bit high just with the way the White Sox were able to find starters midseason with Adrian Hauser and then Yoenis Gomez. Like, I think there comes a point to where winging it is, you know, maybe a better option than throwing too much money at guys who haven't been able to post for that many seasons, just because they have severe needs elsewhere on this roster.
I like the idea, James, especially with this changeup We know Brian Bannister, big changeup guy. The White Sox seem to love changeups. So I'm going to give it a thumbs up. Even if it does inch up closer to $9 to $10 million for the asking price from Scott Boris or Chris Paddock for a year, fully understanding that the goal is for Paddock to pitch really well and get traded in July. So that's why I'll give it a thumbs up. How about you, Jim?
Thumb sideways. Like I said, like depends on the dollar.
Depends on the price.
Yeah. He's cost sensitive.
What else you got, James?
So this next tier, what did I name it? Something wacky. Who is sort of interesting? Dustin May. And I think one of the big parts of the appeal is, ooh, Dustin May, that's a name. That is baked into the price. That little ooh you have, that's an extra million on the AAV. He's a former, top 25 prospect, consensus pre-2020. Has obviously been like a big part of like the Dodgers operation at times. Been extremely not healthy. He has made 43 starts over the last four seasons. The 130-ish innings he threw last year, albeit not great ones with the ERA in the very high fours, was career high in innings. His velocity's backed up a couple ticks. He was a 4.94/4.96 last year. He has never had a changeup of really consequence. His sinker and sweeper, he's never generated a lot of whiffs with it, and the ground balls weren't especially consistent this past year. But obviously just like a very talented arm and just sort of like the guy, like, probably if you're thinking about like what points where the White Sox needed to trade for pitching, like prohibitively expensive and not someone you would think that they have the capital to like acquire at his peak. And now he's kind of at this down point. At the same time, as Jim pointed out, like maybe Yoandrés Gómez means that the White Sox can, resuscitate guys who have been with premier development orgs like the Yankees and Dodgers. With May pitching for both the Red Sox and the Dodgers last year this past season to poor effect. But I would say Yoandrés is more of a guy who like ran out of time with his option situation and was not in a position to be a priority. Whereas like May, clearly the Dodgers wanted to be like a mainstay for years on end and couldn't get him the healthy. And then at the point, the version we saw this year, they obviously didn't feel like could help them downstretch where they are right now. So it's a pure reclamation project. There's definitely not much assurance to, get a lot of innings from him. Like, if he build on 130 or if he just probably 130 again, that would probably mostly do the job. But this is very much like, are you excited about the White Sox getting their hands on Dustin May? That would be the appeal here. Like, that's a name, that's a talent. Could is there more they could get out of him? Is it just worth it to have your whirl at a former top 25 prospect in a situation where if it doesn't work out, you're not, sinking a contending season? I think that's the appeal here more than like he's actually a Martin Perez analog in any way. So Dustin May.
So you mentioned Martin Perez, Jim. I'm thinking with Dustin May, this is your classic 1 year guarantee, a mutual option for year two for creative accounting to get Dustin May under contract for like $5 million in 2026. He can make maybe $10 million in 2027, or it's a $2 million buyout to push $2 million back accounting wise in 2027. I think I'm willing to give Dustin May $5 million to see if he can get himself right and be effective for the White Sox in the starting rotation. So I'll give it a thumbs up, but no more than $5 million in 2026.
Yeah, he was missing two ticks, I think, which is the big red flag for like him being healthy, but also being diminished and trying to identify a strength, I think, is difficult for him. So that's, I think, why, I think the price you set is more or less fair. That will still be way more than he's made just because of all the injuries really hampering his ability to make money through arbitration. I just, just missing two ticks is hard to overcome. I do like watching him. Like I enjoy the gangle and lope in his physical actions being 6'6", 180 and just moving around in a very goofy fashion, having some weird reactions. Would enjoy watching him. I'm not sure that the upside is there to where like you sell out for him. I think it has more of like a Noah Syndergaard feel of just like, looks the same, stands out when you see him on a field. You won't mistake him for anybody else. But then when you see the stuff, it's just kind of sad. And you realize like, oh, that's not going to work. So yeah, I would say thumbs up, but yeah, under five.
All right, James, who's next? By the way, we've been giving thumbs up except for Martin Perez. I'm sorry, Martin.
May is kind of like the excitement is the White Sox getting a nice thing, I guess. Even if it's like, you know, they found it at the thrift store a little bit. This is like if you don't think that they have that level of access, I guess, or it's definitely a lower grade dream, which is Anthony DeSclafani because he's, you know, not a recent top 25 prospect in this decade, but a 36-year-old who hasn't had like a full effective season since 2021.
Somehow 10 years of service time. I didn't realize that. 11 years of service time.
So obviously that 2021 season, which is so productive, was with the Giants, where, you know, Brian Bannister was kind of overseeing. Not their, you know, he wasn't their pitching coach, but was on top of, in a similar role to what he is now with the White Sox. So there's obviously familiarity there. And, you know, that group got it effective in the past. And while, you know, he missed all of 2024, he's with the Twins and he hurt his elbow in spring and then missed the whole season and then only resurfaced last year, a couple ineffective stints with the Yankees AAA and then end of the season with the Diamondbacks when they were super desperate pitching and neither really produced numbers that were impressive. I was intrigued that he fashioned like a new splitter in his Diamondbacks tenure and it was like extremely effective, like sub 100 batting average against with no extra base hits. Obviously some unfamiliarity there, but if you're signing this sort of project, you want the, what's the new pitch we're developing. And at least you have that going in a little bit with this. Even if, you know, you'd like that he, you know, pitch good, you know, mop up innings for the Diamondbacks rather than middling ones. But, you know, he's a name. He has thrown lots of innings before. It's possible. Anthony DeSclafani.
Yeah, I'm out on this one, Jim. This is a thumbs down. The age 36 is maybe on a minor league contract, but yeah, I'm gonna pass.
Feels like Bryce Wilson level commitment. There's no such bad thing as a bad one-year $1 million deal. That's kind of where I am with him. But yeah, anything requiring multiple million and commitment, thumbs down.
Yeah. All right. That was
let's give Martin Perez some company here.
Yeah.
How about Eric Fetty? You know Eric Fetty. He nearly made an all-star team here. Guess what? You're not going to believe this. He's available. Probably maybe even for a lower price than last time, which was pretty affordable. You know, we've seen him be good. It was just last year. It was really something. It was a sub 4 ERA with peripherals to match. It kind of backed up a little bit in St. Louis. Oh man, did this past year not go well? Everything got whacked. Everything was less consistent. He very much looked like somebody just like without the stuff to get outs, and that like led to long more walks and long counts and just a lot of home runs. I think he'd be down. I think interest is there. I've heard stories that, you know, he knows that his basically most effective stint of his career is with the White Sox. So maybe, I don't know if you know, Ethan Katz departing is, you know, puts a crimp in it for him, but obviously he's had success with Bannister in the past. I don't think it would be the proven commodity with what he's coming with, possibly even less so than coming off of a KBO MVP award. He feels more unproven as a guy we just saw pitch in the majors last year than a guy no one saw at all. But hey, good clubhouse presence. Great dude. Great interview. Would love to have him. From a personality standpoint, I can't tell you what results to expect. He probably can't either at this point, but how about it? Love's loving you the second time around.
I don't know, Jim. There's a part of me that's like, all right, like James is, he's making a decent pitch. Again, it's kind of like, well, if you're willing to give Dustin May $5 million, would you give Eric Fetty $5 million? I feel like that's a little too much for Eric Fetty. So if Fetty is willing to take on like a Carlos Rodon, redeem yourself type of contract, $3 million, and see if you can not be awful, I guess. But I don't know. I'm leaning towards thumbs down, Jim.
give him a thumbs up. It would be like another Freddie Garcia development, to where like the White Sox trade him for a pretty good haul, and then like he flops with the Phillies, and then the Tigers and the White Sox are like, hey, Freddie Garcia, want to come back? And it's like, yeah, I liked it here. And then he gives you two more good useful seasons before moving on. And so I will, if Fetty, yeah, I gotta go Freddie and Fetty, so it's just one letter off, it gets even stronger. So with Fetty, having done it with the White Sox, that there are some changes in his profile. The arm strength seems to be there. The access to some of his pitches has not been. And that's a case of, is he compromising somehow, or is he just off? Do the White Sox know how to get him right? Like, question worth exploring for the right amounts. I certainly like him more than, say, thinking about Chris Paddock and what the price he might command. Like, certainly I like him more for what I think he's going to cost than Paddock. So okay, I give him a thumbs up in that regard. Also, how many people want to be with the White Sox right now? Like, want to, craving it, it would be thrilled to be back. Doesn't that count for something?
If I can weigh in, I think Eric Fetty in camp sounds great. Great idea. Love to have him. Good talent to try out. If Eric Fetty's introduced is like, here's our replacement for Perez, and they're slapping him on the arm, like, there's 180 innings in that bad boy, and like, this is plan A, I think that would be like, given what he went through last year, maybe that's a little, maybe we could have a contingency plan here, rather than like, this is our one solution to add innings to the rotation. I think he's probably, stretched for that at this point.
Okay, so James is leaning towards minor league contract, invite to spring training.
Well, mostly including him was a narrative device to talk about the next Eric Fetty. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking
about KBO guys.
Like the Bryce Wilson to the Martin Perez. Secondary, exactly. Lesser investment who also might serve a purpose or might not.
Yeah, like his signing comes with and he's going to get a chance to compete for a rotation slot.
Yeah.
Sort of a thing rather than, is he the opening day starter? Sort of like article following up. Okay. To moving to the Pacific Rim, which traditionally is an area where you can kind of find talent for where the quality might be ahead of what the market value is, just because they're playing in an inferior league. I don't know if I should submit this one up, but maybe why not? We're here to talk and gab, but I think Cody Ponce is the kind of best pitcher coming over this year. He's a former, obviously, I want to say Pirates prospect, but I didn't have him so much as a member on the list because I think he looks kind of like traditionally good. He's throwing like 95, 96. He had an insane strikeout rates, over 35%, just a dominant ace season, and especially after Fetty's success, I think somebody dominating that league with just obvious louder stuff on video is probably going to get 3 years or more, or maybe even four, at probably a better rate than Fetty did as well. I think if the White Sox signed Cody Ponce, that would be amazing. But as far as does he fit this archetype of innings eater, yeoman work guy, I think it'd be more like a, wow, cool, you guys are kind of stepping forward in your regression, maybe a bit more than we anticipated type of signing. But I don't know if you guys have Cody Ponce's thoughts in a vacuum.
252 strikeouts in 180 innings in Korea last year. I mean, that's eye opening, but his Japan numbers are not. So I'm curious in what happened in Korea where he had a lot more success.
He's lost a bunch of weight. He's gotten an amazing shape. He used to be more towards the high 200s, and now he's looks 50 to 60 pounds lighter, and holding velocity deep into the playoffs. They're in the Korea series finals.
Okay, so you're thinking Ponce is going to get better than what Eric Fetty did 2 years, $14 million when he signed with the White Sox.
Yeah, if he was three or four with 15 to 20 AAV, I wouldn't shock me. If he got 345, that, I don't know if I'm coming light on him, but that wouldn't surprise me at all.
I guess I just don't know enough So I guess if the stuff's that good now and he's lost a ton of weight and it shows, I mean, 252 strikeouts, 180 innings, Jim, in a league that really values contact in Korea, I guess I'd have to pull up the film and YouTube clips and engage for myself, but I'm sold. Thumbs up. Sure. Go ahead, White Sox. Surprise us.
Spoiler alert, I'll be thumbs up on anybody from KBO or NPB just because I enjoy the work of looking at their film and hearing about the different experiences. And it's an area that I would like to see the White Sox scout more. And I think we've heard about that with David Keller, like the White Sox are trying to get a footprint there, even though it's not, you know, at the level of other teams yet. At least they're paying attention to it in a way that they hadn't paid attention to it before. So I tend to be thumbs up on anybody who, you know, from Yokohama or Rakuten or anything, just like, yep, easy. So I don't care for what amount, bring them over. But more seriously, one is, I looked it up while you guys were talking. His name is Ponce. I was looking up highlights. Oh, Ponce. So okay. Ponce, because I wasn't sure. So there's that. And then when it comes to like the investment, I kind of have the same apprehensions of a 3-year deal based on what we talked about with Littell. But I think like 2 years, like he's the kind of arm where we saw the White Sox be rewarded for it with Fetty, like going out and going further with a 2-year deal than any other team was willing to do. Like it'd be a case where like, if you were able to sign for 2 years, I would hope the White Sox would be pretty aggressive in that regard. Cause I think like, that's the kind of play where if they're going to be better sooner, he would be, you know, that kind of signing, him over delivering on a 2-year deal because of the mystery he has would be, something that helps propel the White Sox into the next tier. It's just a case where, you know, he's looking to see how old he is. So yeah, he'll be 32 next year, age 32 season. So like you're talking about like 32, 33, 34. Yeah, how is he going to age with this profile is kind of more open question. And then you get back to my fears of, can the White Sox spend past bad deals, or do they treat him as like millstones when they're actually trying to shift resources around to compete and really make additions that matter?
Yeah, swirling in my head, Jim, for Ponce, maybe 2 years, $20 million with incentives. Like every innings number that you hit, 100, 110, 120, give you like $50,000. Like $10 million base, but with incentives that Ponce can earn more money. That's what I think I would offer. Obviously, I need to watch a lot more film to be more comfortable, but I'm still going to give it a thumbs up, James. I think Jim and I are both a thumbs up on Ponce.
So the other, like, I was working with Eric Long and hanging on, you know, just doing a lot of like these MPB and KBO guys. And I became somewhere in like a certain point of like watching scouting video over and over again, like your brain unhooks and you're giving your way to impulse. And I fell in love with a lot of like guys who were throwing fastballs that look like they're going to get like absolutely whacked in Major League Baseball. Like a lot of I guess both pitcher I'm talking about are Japanese, where you see a lot of guys who have higher slots where they're, because they throw so many splitters over there. And, you know, if you think of your average like swing with a little bit of like uphill plane to it, and you think of like a fastball with a high slot where it's kind of coming down, they kind of line up a bit more than your flatter plane arm. So Hiroto Saiki throws like 93 out of the slot. That really gives me a lot of concerns about where his fastball is going to play. And obviously doesn't like miss a ton of bats there either. He doesn't miss a lot of bats there at all. It's a sub 20 strikeout rate in the MPB. And it's, I think like last year was like his lowest in a while. He's also a sub 2 ERA in all of his last 4 years in MPB. He hasn't like made more than 25 starts in a season, so it's not like the perfect picture of health. And he's a slender dude for sure, which kind of makes you dream, like, could he add velocity down the road? Like I want to say he's turning 27 soon, but just exquisite command, just like moving this vulnerable fastball of his own. Like he's dotting on the edges a lot. He's got like a couple breaking balls that he locates well, but like, you feel like there should be more in there. Like his slider doesn't miss a ton of bats. His curveball doesn't either. His split looks like plus right now, but like, I think for someone like him to survive would be like really using a wide four pitch mix to get around like how much he'd probably have to shield his fastball a little bit. But it seems like there should be meaty on the bone a little bit for like his breaking balls. And it's just like, would this fan base, I guess, buy into like, I think they would, like a guy who really just paints all over the zone. It gets a lot of weak contact, like throws a lot of strikes and just gives himself a chance to compete. Like, his results have been really good. It's very beautiful to watch him pitch, just to see him like kind of move the ball around. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if do him separately, but like, I think Kona Takahashi is like kind of a similar boat. I think he's a little bit worse than him. I think the fastball is even a little bit more vulnerable and his command is not as good. I think I put like a 65 on Saiki's command and like I put obviously Takahashi is just like 55, 60, but they're both like this, not soft tossing, like I guess 93 in this day and age is, you know, it is below average velocity, but it's not like, you know, way well below average, but it's this both like not overpowering brand of like command artist Japanese pitcher with both of them that I think it'd be just fun to see if it works, but I can't say I have like, oh, we've seen this profile work time over yeah. after time. We've certainly seen like, you know, there's guys like, you know, Hiroki Kuroda who, you know, pitch very well at an advanced stage without overpowering stuff. But there's also been guys who kind of come over here and get their doors blown off. And I can't tell you like what they would be, especially in year one, to adjusting to like a very new style of hitting. Like, I don't think it's either one's fastball gets exploited in that area. Both of them, like as much as like they have a little fastball, still throw it 50% of the time there or a little bit more. I think it'd be a lot less here and you'd see like a very different animal in how they pitch. With the command back up a little bit if they're throwing more secondaries. A lot of questions, but also just kind of fun dudes to watch. And, you know, you're watching tape of them like going into the seventh in a playoff game. You're like, man, they're pitching like the days of old. Like, this is what I want, even if you don't think that's how they'd be used if they came over. So they're fun guys, but I don't know.
What is the comp to, like, is this like a Shota Imanaga type of situation?
Or Tomoyuki Sugano was the one I was thinking of in terms of not impressive strikeout rates, you know, very command oriented, gave a lot of homers to the Orioles, but also pitched 150 innings for him.
Yeah, I think that'd be probably a hope. And obviously, Sugano's a free agent this year. So maybe just add him to the pile on top of everything else. But I'd hope they'd be a tick better than Sugano was. And they're certainly younger and maybe a little bit more. Hope that they can, you know, go on a little multi-year run of being an effective mid-rotation starter, but that's not unreasonable. It's tough to add compared to Imanaga just because like they're righties, and I think Imanaga gets a little bit of allowances and his fastball is going to play a little bit better just being left-handed.
Okay,
if I wanted to go crazy, they're both Mark Burley, obviously. If Mark Burley threw a high slot splitter instead of a great straight changeup.
Well, Jim's an automatic thumbs up, but mm-hmm. he recently said, I think I'm going to need to watch more film. I don't know. The way that you pitched it to me, James, I think I'm going to have to go thumbs down. I don't know about that arm angle. And if you're already telling me he's going to have to throw different, I'm like, okay, so you're starting over? You're just bringing this guy over from Japan and start over?
So. I mean, I think both of them, it's like, if like Banister and the pitch dev, in general just like loves them, like I'm all in. If they're like me where it's like maybe you're not the winning bid there.
Yeah, a little hesitancy. Okay, got it. All right.
Yeah, Sugano made $13 million for his 1 year with the Orioles.
So yes. The other alternatives would be kind of the I guess the returning Americans brand of this, where I view them similarly on especially Anthony Kay as a similar, like, he's commanded. He does throw 94 from the left side, but like it's never been like super hoppy. So what he's done to have success in the MPP the last 2 years is he's throwing like it's a little bit like left-handed Mason Adams, where it's three different fastball shapes. It's four seamer, sinker, and cutter, and he's getting a lot of weak contact over that. He was a former first round pick for the Mets because he's like had a dominant changeup and he like junked it entirely at one point. He's using it again. It's pretty good, but he's losing it less than 20% of the time. He's not like a Tommy Malone changeup guy. He's more of like throw a bunch of like different looking fastballs in the zone and get weak contact. And he does have a good changeup. I think it's looking swing manish, but as far as like his stuff, but this is a guy who just had a sub two ERA season in MPB and threw over 150 innings. So he's had success being your, you know, back of the rotation, mixing it up in the zone, dude. And to really, I don't want to maybe wrap the segment up a little bit, but also to group in White Sox legend Drew Anderson through over, I want to say over 107 innings. I want to say he's KBO. Yes, he's KBO, so SSG lighter. He's going to be 32, but, you know, he's, you know, struck out over 12 per nine. He flashed like stretches of good, like being 96, 97. It wasn't super consistent. And that's why I kind of think I'd probably like be more confident that he could be like a good reliever. But he's okay. Also someone who threw 170 innings last year. So he's very stretched out. Like, if all the concerns you have about, like, oh, how many innings does Shane Smith have next year? Or how many innings will, if you do get Drew Thorpe or, you know, guys like that back from TJ, like, how restricted are they? Obviously, having somebody who just had, you know, 170 innings, you have a little bit of, like, we can use him as much as we need. You know, obviously, he's older. He's not part of the future. Like, this is somebody you can kind of use how you will. With both of them, I would say, I think they're both swingman, multi-inning relievers on a good team, but maybe at least certainly to start out the season with the White Sox, you could certainly stretch out the idea of like, hey, they just had really good seasons as starters in an inferior league. Why not us give it a roll as like whether or not he could do the same thing here? And I think they'd both be like, I don't think they'd do better than the Fetty contract. Certainly because of their stuff profiles, and also like both of them are known commodities. You know, they've both been here and follow. They don't look radically different. They're not throwing to like a crazy different arm angle or using like a crazy different arsenal. So I think they're in that low cost bucket a little bit where they just pitch a full season and stretched out. They had success. They threw strikes, but you know, not like stuff that's going to light the world on fire.
This is the Bryce Wilson type of contract for me, Jim. Yes, for below $3 million.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of thumbs up. Drew Anderson had the 40-50 ERA with the 2020 White Sox.
I forgot that game. He gave up six runs in an inning and a third.
And his defense's FIP was only 24-19. So.
Oh, wow.
He did, well, that, I remember that game because we were all like, why did they bring him out for a second inning? He got hammered. And then post game, it's like we were planning on him throwing five innings, and we were like, "What? We did not know like that he was stretched out in summer camp. We didn't know this was a thing." And then he never pitched for the team again. And we're like, "Was he really part of the rotation plan? If you got like 5 outs of a look at it and abandoned ship, it was a weird episode in life." But great to see that he's shoving.
Yeah. Well. I think I probably prefer K over Anderson. So if I only had to pick one, thumbs up on Anthony K.
K is the one, like, you know, besides, you know, not being a Venezuelan man, like he pitches and he looks like Martin Perez. He's lefty. He's mixing it up. He's throwing different fastballs in zone. He's not striking people out. He's getting some ground balls. Like if you wanted like to just find someone who pitches like Martin Perez, I think Anthony K is like the best, like, this is right off the assembly line.
All right. You sold me. Thumbs up on Anthony K. Jim, your thumbs up on both?
Yes.
You got anybody else, James, or is that it?
That was, I haven't gone deep into the comments about you know, what other people.
Adrian Hauser was the one along the lines of Eric Fetty.
United with an old friend. Thumbs up on Adrian Hauser. I'm okay bringing him back.
I mean, it clearly worked.
Did he enjoy his time with the White Sox?
I mean, yes. Like, in the sense, like, he felt like he relaunched his career with the White Sox. Like, I remember, like, how emotional he got, like, after his last start. Like, I think part of that was, like, the difficulty of his season because he, like, just had his wife and his small child were in a different city. And he was kind of, like, taking this big bet on himself to opt out of his contract and then come with the White Sox. The idea he's launched, like, he would... you know, boost his career, but he did. Like he pitched so well and he got some attention. I think he earned himself some good money, certainly more than he got last year. I don't know if it'd be like out of the White Sox price range type of money, but so yeah, I think he would have nothing negative to say about the White Sox. I think he also probably needs a score that he was getting dealt and that'd be a situation. And that obviously would be a possibility if he came back with where the White Sox are. Does he want to go through that again? Does he think that's just the cost of business, or would he rather stay in place as one for a full year after, you know, such a hectic season last year? I think that'd be a fair specification for him if he could get it. I don't think we could begrudge him for that.
Going back to Anthony Kaye, I was thinking Mets first round pick and the White Sox have liked those guys before. In terms of they've had Justin Dunn, who was picked the year or the same draft class as Anthony Kaye. White Sox took a look at him. Also, the 3-year run of Mike Pelfrey, Philip Umber, and Lastings Millage. White Sox employed them all. So the trips in my head of like the White Sox have liked these guys before. And so that would be my leading candidates for them kicking the tires on him.
Well, this was a fun exercise. It gave me extra names to think about, James. So thank you so much for playing along with us in this game. And thank you for doing this well-researched list. And for our podcast listeners working on off-season plan projects, maybe a couple of names that you didn't think of that maybe you would add to your list. Can't wait to see your guys' plans. Again, go to SoxMachine.com. When is that post going to be live, Jim, that people can start submitting?
Go with 9 a.m. Central Time.
9 a.m. on Friday, Halloween, you can start submitting your off-season plans, and I'll start working on mine, and you can make fun of it or rip it apart next week on SoxMachine.com, but can't wait to see your guys' plans. And that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on all the social media platforms. We are at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You follow me at SoxMachine_Josh, especially since we will be posting updates on how we are faring with the donation to the Southside Food Drive. Again, thank you guys so much for your continued support in that campaign. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Your support is really going to come in handy because in the next couple of months here, we're sending James to Las Vegas for the GM meetings. We have already booked our flights. We are planning to be in Orlando and reporting in Orlando during the winter meetings. And that is in huge support. And it goes a long way thanks to all the subscriptions that we have at SoxMachine.com. So if you're listening to this and you currently don't subscribe to the Sox Machine, monthly plans start at $5. You get an ad-free version of both the podcast and website. It unlocks the comment section. We also have additional tiers of support that give you additional benefits, including some spots open in our Veterans Committee, which you get to be part of the group chat. You have direct access to Jim and James. If you're part of the VC group, James has already told you the names of the White Sox are already kicking around for the hitting and pitching coaches. So if you want that level of intel, sign up to become a Sox Machine supporter at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside James Fegan and Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.